Coming up, helping the country's wounded veterans with their families at their side. And a Latino spiritual tradition, the Day of the Dead.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. The estate of William J. Carter, the Jane Henson Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. A new Vatican document this week called for sweeping changes in the global financial system in order, it said, to put the common good at the center of economic activity. One of the most controversial proposals would create an international political authority that would have broad power to regulate financial markets. The document was issued by the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. It said changes are needed to address the, quote, inequalities and distortions of capitalist development. Meanwhile, in many cities around the world, the Occupy movement continues its campaigns for economic justice. Here in the U.S., religious leaders raised concerns about how some cities have been cracking down on the protests. The group Faithful America launched a petition drive urging local authorities to refrain from violence. The faith community has been playing an increasingly visible role in many of the protests. Kim Lawton reports on some of the religious activities around Occupy Wall Street.
For the Occupy Wall Street protesters in New York's Zuccotti Park, it's become a familiar sight, religious groups offering spiritual and moral support.
We represent
the New York City communities of faith.
The New York City communities of faith.
Growing numbers of leaders from across the religious spectrum have been supporting Occupy Wall Street's protest against greed and economic inequity.
This is not just a jobs issue. This is not only a health care issue or a pension issue. This is also a spiritual issue about the nature of what's happened in the United States and how we function as a people together. And that is very, very much a matter of moral concern, not only to my Christian tradition, but to Islam and to Judaism, to Buddhism.
There have been regular interfaith prayer services at the park, and religious groups are also providing practical help by donating tents, food, and money. They've been opening their facilities to the protesters, giving logistical advice, and helping to get the message out.
Churches are an excellent place to organize this kind of information because we're under the radar of commerce or of government.
Many say there's a prominent spiritual dimension to what's been happening. Inside Zuccotti Park is a makeshift community altar where protesters of all faiths come to pray or meditate. In several cities, protest chaplains, many of them seminary students, minister to the protesters.
We are here to provide a religious presence. We are here to listen to people, to hear what's on their hearts, and we're here to pray with people. And people do come up to us and ask us to sit with them in prayer because people are in crisis, and that's why we're all here.
On this Sunday, United Methodists led a communion service. Participants said concern for economic justice is a core teaching of their faith.
The Bible's all about just a fairer shake for people and God's concern for all of God's children, not just a small segment of the population.
Some religious conservatives have criticized the faith-based support of Occupy Wall Street, calling it a 60s-style leftist effort to redistribute wealth. The Family Research Council urged its members to pray that God would prevent what it called these radical organizers from stirring revolution. But faith leaders at the Wall Street protests deny any political agenda.
It's a broad movement of religious groups to support what's going on and really to support the conversation, not to take a particular side or another side, but just to say these are the things we need to talk about.
And they say it's only going to spread.
What's very, very real is the frustration. And if people don't think that's real, if people don't think that reflects a real existential reality for the majority of Americans, the faith communities see it. Because we're who they come to when mom can't pay rent, when the immigration officers steal grandma and there's no one home. I mean, we're who they come to. So for us, it's an obvious, immediate moral imperative.
I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
Yes, 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 Lord, yes, yes, Lord, amen.
Meanwhile, in London, the Chancellor of St. Paul's Cathedral resigned, he says, because of the way top church officials have handled the protests there. Demonstrators began camping out by St. Paul's 2 weeks ago. Although the church initially welcomed the protesters, health and safety concerns grew and the cathedral was forced to close for a time. The Anglican Bishop of London and other church officials have asked the protesters to leave. In this week's resignation, Canon Chancellor Giles Fraser said he was concerned that church actions could lead to violence. In Washington, members of the faith community continued lobbying Congress to protect a program that helps feed the poor. Religious leaders joined lawmakers at a Capitol Hill grocery store for what they called the Food Stamp Challenge. Participants in the challenge shopped for a week's worth of groceries but couldn't spend more than $31.50, the average allotment for those receiving food assistance. Several commented on how hard it was to stay on budget. New numbers released this week from the Congressional Budget Office show how much income inequality has grown in the U.S. over the last three decades. The report says the incomes of the top 1% of the country grew by 275%. Between 1979 and 2007. Incomes of the lowest 20% grew by only 18%. Giving to the poor was one of many issues raised in a new survey of U.S. Catholics. According to the results, 60% now believe you can be a good Catholic without donating time or money to the poor. That number was 44% in 2005. The survey also found that a majority of Catholics now believes that individuals, not church authorities, should be the ones to make decisions about abortion, homosexuality, and other social issues. Joining me now are Kim Lawton, managing editor of this program, and Kevin Ekstrom, editor of Religion News Service. Welcome to you both. Kevin, can you explain this astonishing figure that 60% of those surveyed, 60% of Catholics in this country say they can be good Catholics without at the same time giving money to the poor or giving time to helping the poor?
It's one of the great sort of paradoxes that the survey picked up. You know, the other figure that was worth mentioning here is that two out of three Catholics said that helping the poor and the church's teaching on the poor is important to me as a Catholic. So they see it as core to the Catholic identity, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're actually going to go out and do something about it. And it's sort of broadly reflective of this trend that the survey picked up, that I'm a Catholic and I'll go to Mass because I want the Eucharist, I want the liturgy, I think that the core teachings are important, but I'm not going to do it because some bishop somewhere tells me that I have to. You know, weekly Mass attendance is down to like 30%. And you know, the number of people who go to church once a month is actually higher than people who go to weekly. So people are doing it on their own terms.
And also in that survey, it did find that a big majority, 88% of Catholics, said that helping the poor, it was meaningful for them that their church had concern for the poor. It's just, again, what the church says and does and how it translates into individuals' lives. As one author of the survey said, American Catholics like being Catholic, but they like to do it on their own terms as well.
And the confirmation of this, of some other long trends, for instance, making up your own mind about social and moral concerns rather than taking instructions from the hierarchy.
Yeah, the big number there was on homosexuality, which is sort of a flashpoint issue, but I think it's telling. The number of people who say the church and church leaders should have the final word on the morality of homosexuality or same-sex marriage has dropped by half in the last 25 years. No other issue has seen that sort of shift. But I think that's really telling, where people say, you know what, I've got gay friends, I've got gay brother or gay neighbors. There's a disconnect here between what the church is telling me and what my life experience is telling me. And so I'm not going to necessarily go along with the church on this one.
And what are the implications of a third of Catholics now being Hispanic?
Well, within a generation, they're likely to be the majority of the Catholic Church in the United States. And what that means, in practical terms, is that Spanish language Mass might become the norm, and English language Mass is going to be sort of what they do on the side on Saturday nights.
And some of these economic issues may come to the fore as well. And again, going back to the Vatican document, I mean, a lot of the input for that came from outside the United States, as church leaders from, Europe, but also Latin America, have contributions about what the church has to say about the poor. And sometimes American Catholics there was a lot of mixed reaction among American Catholics to that Vatican document. I mean, some religious conservatives, Catholic conservatives, really tried to dismiss it a little bit and say it didn't have the full force of a papal teaching, but it certainly did quote from popes who have raised concerns about the poor.
And reminded everybody about how very liberal church teachings are about how the poor should be treated.
Catholic social teaching does have what many people consider very liberal values when it comes to the poor. Some of the folks this week tried to associate this document with the Occupy Wall Street folks, and the Vatican officials said this was not a direct response to Occupy Wall Street. But I saw a lot of similar language. The Vatican document criticized excessive greed as being sinful and evil. Certainly that's a big theme with Occupy Wall Street. Talked about social inequities being morally wrong. And again, that's in the Vatican document.
Yeah. Many thanks to Kim Lawton and to Kevin Ekstrom. President Obama announced last week that almost all U.S. troops will be out of Iraq by the end of this calendar year. For many severely wounded veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, however, there's no end to the medical and social adjustments they're facing, often alone. But there's a place in Texas where wounded warriors, as they call them, can be treated with their families beside them. Lucky Severson reports.
This is the Brook Army Medical Center in San Antonio, the military's largest and most advanced medical facility. It's where doctors send some of the most seriously burned and wounded soldiers to recover, sometimes with artificial limbs. Since the beginning of the Iraq and Afghanistan war, thousands of soldiers, like Private Carlos Gomez, have suffered injuries like his. He was on a scouting mission and was seriously wounded when his vehicle ran over a roadside bomb in Afghanistan earlier this year.
Well, the blast, it shot us straight up in the air. So the impact automatically broke my left leg, it shattered my heel, and my bones down my right left leg, And my right leg got crushed. They couldn't save it anymore, so they had to amputate it here at Brook Army Medical Center.
Two other soldiers were wounded in the blast. One was killed. At first, Gomez wasn't sure he wanted to live.
I woke up, not really knowing what happened still. I didn't know that my leg was amputated. And when I was fully, aware of what's going on, and I saw my leg, I broke down in tears. I hated my life, and I didn't want nothing to do with it.
The first battle many seriously wounded soldiers face is whether they want to go on with their lives and then endure the long, painful process of healing, often alone.
Doctors have learned that wounded soldiers heal faster and more completely when they have family around them. That's what happens here at the Warrior and Family Support Center in San Antonio. It is the only one of its kind.
It was a dream of Judith Markell's, and now she's the director.
We attempt to form a home away from home for wounded warriors and their families, to help them feel some kind of connection to each other, things for them to do every day to take them outside of their own world, and help them transition to back to active duty or to the civilian community, where they're going to have to adjust and make a lot of changes.
Although it's located on an Army post, the Warrior and Family Support Center is funded entirely from private donations and staffed by about 150 volunteers. Families live in apartments close by.
Thank you very much, and thank you for everything you guys do for us.
So they can help soldiers accept what is called the new normal. which means their life will never be quite the same again. Sometimes family is as important as the medical care.
To know that someone is there, that someone that comes from home to take care of you, makes a tremendous difference for our warriors. If you believe in the triad of the healing of the mind, body, and spirit, then we probably fall in the category of the healing of the spirit.
Brian Castile is a Baptist chaplain at the center. He says the most important part of his job is simply to be there.
You know, sometimes you want to find the right word. I found many times with dealing with soldiers, there's not a right word. You know, there's no right way to tell someone you're going to be okay. And some say, hey, can you pray for me, chaplain? You know, can you let me know things are going to be all right? I said, I can't promise you, but I can promise you I'll be here to support you.
I-27. One of the favorite nights around here is bingo night. For a while, they forget that the war for them is not yet over. For those who think this must be a very sad place, Judith Markels says the opposite is true. She says it's a place of hope, which is the name of the sculpture hanging in the center, which was created by a staff sergeant who had 29 surgeries while he was at Brook. She says the wounded may cry in their beds at night, but never in public.
These young men do, and women do not want your sympathy. They want your support and in the help of their healing, because they're going to be okay. They did what they were commanded to do, and they did it with great integrity and honor.
And many paid a huge price, like Master Sergeant Doug Reed with the Ohio National Guard, critically wounded by a rocket-propelled grenade in Afghanistan in 2010. He's the father of 7 kids, here with his wife, Jana.
Angel of death had me in its arms, and Jesus said, no, I'm not done with you. So they fought over me, and my jaw came off.
He was very close to death. In the fact that, I mean, with every surgery, they didn't know if he would ever wake up or ever become independent. And so that's when I just had to say, okay, God, I am not in control. The doctors are not in control, but you are in control, and you are going to have to fix this if this is what you want.
And when he finally did wake up, for 2 months, he didn't know his wife. He didn't even know who he was.
But when our kids walked in the door, he gave them a hug, and he called them all by their pet names. And so the kids began to cry, not because of what they saw, but because it's Dad. He does know me, when the doctors were saying, we don't think he'll know you.
I didn't know what I looked like, but it couldn't have been good. They don't see that. They don't care if I have teeth or not, or my jaw is out of shape now, or anything else. But they cared about I was still alive. I was still with them.
Judith Markell says the families themselves need support.
This is not a singular effort. It involves families, children, wives, mothers. An injury or a death is like dropping a rock in the water and the ripples go forever. And they affect everyone with whom they ever came in contact.
Private Gomez has 2 children, and he says he knows things will get better when he gets his prosthesis. But in the meantime, his 7-year-old son is having a hard time.
It's affecting him. I know definitely it's affecting him. You know, he has to help out his dad a lot with stuff that I can't do, like, you know, picking stuff up for me or, you know, putting on my shoes or stuff like that.
Gomez says he's always been religious, that one of the few times he didn't have time to pray was when he rushed out on a mission in the middle of the night. The mission that cost him his leg. He says the war has not cost him his faith.
I don't question God, not one day, you know, why this happened to me. I thank him, actually, because it could have been the opposite. You know, I could have paid the ultimate sacrifice and passed away. It was because of him I'm still sitting here talking to you right now.
Jana Reed says her faith and her husband's are actually stronger.
Because every day we have a miracle that has been answered. And some people might say, oh, it's a coincidence. But we've just had too many coincidences in the past 16 months that I do not accept it. It is not a coincidence.
Chaplain Castile says he has seen how the Warrior and Family Support Center has helped soldiers get better quicker. But he worries about what happens when the soldiers go home.
When you walk around here, you don't feel like you're different. You don't feel like, wow, someone's staring at me or looking at me like I'm strange. And so I think here for a soldier, it can be safe. Now, when they leave this environment, going back to their home of record, then it could be a little more challenging. And I think that anxiety rises again for the soldier. Hey, will I be accepted?
There was a time when wounded soldiers returning from the Vietnam War received more hostility than community support. But times have changed.
Whether you agree with what these young men and women did is of, frankly, no concern to me. If you don't like the war, it is not an issue for me. The issue is that we continue to support these young men and women for the rest of our days and theirs, because this doesn't end tomorrow.
She says there are now other warrior and family support centers being built around the country, modeled after the one here. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in San Antonio, Texas.
In other news, Jewish chaplains now have a memorial in Arlington National Cemetery. The new monument, unveiled on Monday, honors the 14 Jewish chaplains who died on active duty in and since World War II. There were already memorials for Catholic chaplains, Protestant chaplains, and chaplains killed during World War I. Pope Benedict XVI welcomed more than 300 representatives from different faith traditions and some non-believers to Assisi this week. They gathered to mark the 25th anniversary of a day-long summit for peace held there by Pope John Paul II. In his comments, Benedict condemned any use of religion to justify violence. At the original meeting in 1986, some Catholics objected to members of different faiths praying together. This year's service did not include a joint prayer. On our calendar this week, Sunday is Reformation Day for Protestants, recalling the time in 1517 when Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the Castle Church door in Wittenberg in Germany. The following day, October 31st, is All Hallows' Eve, Halloween, and on November 1st, Christians celebrate All Saints' Day, a time to honor saints and martyrs. All Souls' Day is celebrated November 2nd by Catholics and some Protestants. Prayers are said for loved ones who have died. Many Latinos also observe November 2nd as the Day of the Dead, when they believe the spirits of the departed return to earth. There are different traditions for this across Latin America. Many Hispanics in the U.S. incorporate their Roman Catholic faith in Day of the Dead observances. Kim Lawton has more.
In many communities, Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead, is a joyful public event with parades celebrating the belief that, for this one day every year, the spirits of loved ones have returned. Families often hold private observances as well.
Estamos de fiesta. Es una fiesta.
We are in a festive mode right now. It's a party.
In Rockville, Maryland, Rocio and Luis Bermudez incorporate their Roman Catholic faith with their Mexican-American traditions, building a special altar in their home. On the altar, they place pictures of their deceased family members and a portrait of the Virgin of Guadalupe. Candles are lit to help the spirits find their way down from heaven. Water is put out to replenish the thirsty souls after their long journey. And since it's a party, the altar is decorated with colorful papers and treats.
The mango, the water, the tequila, it's all as an enticement so that they will come, and when they come, they have their favorite foods that they can celebrate with us.
When the altar is finished, the family offers prayers for both the living and the dead.
We then pray to the Virgin Mary and to the saints and to the Lord so that they're with us as well as our loved ones as a sign of respect for God.
The Bermudez family says the Day of the Dead ritual reflects the Catholic Church's teachings about life and death.
The belief is that When we die, our body physically isn't here, but our spirit still lives on forever. We actually are reborn. So that's what we celebrate. The spirit doesn't die, it lives on.
For the Bermudez family, that's something to celebrate every year.
I believe when I go and I die, my spirit is going to go to heaven. And then every year I will be coming back on the Day of the Dead to visit. down here to my loved ones.
Finally, there's at least one biblical instruction that people all over the world have observed. It's from Genesis, "Be fruitful and multiply." This Monday, according to the United Nations, the number of human beings on Earth will reach 7 billion, up from 6 billion just 12 years ago, on its way to 8 billion around 2023. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, find us on YouTube, watch us anytime, anywhere on smartphones and iPhones. There's also much more on our website. You can comment on all our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from celebrations of the Hindu holiday of Diwali, also known as the Festival of Lights.